On Life and Times on ABC Radio National Summer Season this week, the first in a two-part series on Korea, the Forgotten War. Hello, I'm Sue Clark.
On active service. Taken from official war diaries and eyewitness accounts, from army records and other reliable sources, these are true stories of the Australian Army in action. An army with a proud tradition of service and sacrifice in three world conflicts.
World War I.
World War II.
And the war in Korea.
On active service.
Sunday, June the 25th, 1950. North Korean Communist Armed Forces this morning invaded the Republic of South Korea with tanks and artillery at 11 places along the border and at 3 points on the east coast. The President of South Korea, Dr. Syngman Rhee, made an appeal for aid to General MacArthur in a telephone call to Tokyo shortly after the invasion began.
Well, that was one way Australians in the 1950s heard about the Korean War, through cinema newsreels, radio news and radio dramas. But now it's 2010, and over the next 2 weeks, you'll be listening to a program that was produced by Bill Bunbury for Hindsight in 1998. It's called Korea, the Forgotten War. And in it, Bill will be retracing the history of this conflict through the eyes of the Australians who went through it. Soldiers, sailors, nurses and airmen. And we'll hear a strategic view of the war from historian Geoffrey Gray. Korea is often called the Forgotten War. It came too close on the heels of World War II for a world weary of fighting, and it was often described as a police action, not a proper war. But Korea was a costly test of strength in the Cold War climate of the 1950s, taking a million Korean lives and many more from China and America. And while Australia was a small player in the war, it fought for the first time as part of a United Nations force. The war also took a heavy toll of Australian lives and blighted many more, as we'll hear later in this story. But how did the Korean War start? After World War II, the winners cut the Korean Peninsula almost in half along the 38th parallel, America liberating the south from the Japanese, while the USSR supported a Stalinist state in the north under Kim Il-sung. In the south, the fiercely anti-communist and pro-USA Syngman Rhee became president of half the original country. Any hope that Korea could still be reunited was dashed by mutual provocation and incursions on either side of the 38th parallel, culminating in North Korea's invasion of South Korea in June 1950. But in Australia in that year, even the word Korea didn't mean much to the many who signed up to go there.
I was shearing in Queensland in 1950 and 51. Didn't even know there was a war going on in Korea. I was sitting in the London Hotel in Melbourne reading the Daily News when we saw the ad there calling for volunteers to serve in the K-Force to go to Korea for a two-year service.
The advertisement said, initial training in Australia and further training in Japan.
Well, I wanted to see what was over the other side of the other hill, I suppose. The recruiting mob came through the country towns in Western Australia, and around about Pemberton and Northcliffe there were about a dozen youngsters joined up, and I was one of them.
I travelled down on a rail warrant, and in actual fact the town clerk in the shire office issued me with a rail warrant and he said I was a mug. And I travelled with those words, I travelled down to Melbourne to De Grave Street, and I subsequently was medically examined, you know, and went through the formalities and was formally enlisted and reported to Royal Park. Subsequent from there, we reported several days later to Pakapanyol, where we were issued with clothing and equipment and whatever, and commenced training.
I was born and brought up with the army well and truly ensconced in my blood. My father served in World War One and was badly wounded. His eldest brother served in World War One and won the Victoria Cross. And you can't live in a family situation like that without hearing all the stories. So, when the 39-45 war was on, my eldest brother joined up, my second eldest brother joined up, and I was very, very disappointed when the war stopped, because I was too young. I was only 14, I think. Anyway, when the Korean War started, within a day, I was down to Adelaide and enlisted.
And at the time, when I joined the Army in 1951, my brother worked on the Sun Herald in Melbourne. And he said to me, "You're mad. You know, this is the war that no one wants to know about." He said, "We don't ever print news about it in the paper. It's just, it's not a popular war." And although I knew what was going on, the men themselves knew why they were there, that they were fighting communism, and they were there for the United Nations.
Tuesday, June the 27th, 1950. The Security Council today passed a further resolution requesting members of the United Nations to assist the Republic of Korea to repel the attack by North Korean forces and to restore peace and security to the area. The United States representative informed the Security Council that his government had decided, in accordance with the resolution of Monday, June the 26th, to provide air and sea cover and support to the South Korean government troops.
It was first and clearly a civil war. Something in the order of 100,000 Koreans die before the official beginning of this war in June 1950 in the struggle in the countryside, particularly in the south.
Military historian Geoffrey Gray.
It's also clearly, to some extent, a revolutionary war. It's an attempt by one set of Koreans to fundamentally remake Korean society and the attempt by another set of Koreans to resist that. But thirdly, and here's where it gets really complicated, it's also, of course, an international conflict because it's the first major engagement between the emerging blocs of the Cold War.
The Australian Prime Minister, Mr. Menzies, said in Canberra last night that Australia has offered the RAAF fighter squadron, now based in Japan, for service with General MacArthur's forces in Korea.
You know, we Australians don't always feel that we're in the middle of the map of the world. Sometimes we feel a bit lonely. Sometimes we blow out our chests and make a noise as if we were really very, very important, and then they look at us for a moment. But it's only every now and then that something happens that gets people all around the world really interested in us, really pleased about us, really conscious of the fact that what we're doing counts. I don't want to make a pompous sort of speech on that matter to you because it would be quite inappropriate. I don't want you to go away and say that you've had a lot of political tripe shoved down your throats, but I do want everybody to appreciate this, that this Korean campaign's a tremendous test for civilization. It's a tremendous test of whether the aggressor can get away with it just whenever he wants to get away with it and where he wants to get away with it.
Thursday, July the 27th, 1950. Britain, Australia and New Zealand announced yesterday that in response to the United Nations appeal, they would send ground troops to fight in Korea. Prime Minister Menzies has met with American President Truman and Secretary of State Acheson in Washington.
We talk about Australia being a small power, but countries like Australia and Canada both tended to see themselves in UN terms as middle powers, which in the context of the time was probably a reasonable assumption, and also as having some sway with what Prime Minister Menzies used to refer to as our great and powerful friends, in part, of course, emerging out of the shared experience of victory in the Second World War. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that in 1950, people were not nearly as cynical about the UN. There was a great deal of hope and faith that the United Nations would succeed where the League of Nations had failed. In 1950, certainly in official circles, there was great concern that another global war was imminent. And Menzies certainly held this view. They were very concerned that there might well be a general war within 1 or 2 years at most. And if you think about the international context, culminating in North Korea's invasion of South Korea in 1950, you have the forced incorporation of Czechoslovakia, you have the Berlin blockade, variety of incidents of that sort. You have the Soviet Union successfully testing an atomic bomb, acquiring, therefore, at least in theory, atomic weapons capabilities. All of this coming together at that time and then, as it were, capped by the beginning of the war in Korea, made the international environment seem potentially extremely dangerous. So at some levels, there was very great interest and concern in what was happening in this small, faraway place about which most Australians probably didn't know very much.
I knew it was a United Nations police action, but no, I hadn't really given it a lot of thought. And I suppose, in a way, I had that hangover that it was the right thing to do for them to be there. And so, yes, I wanted to go to help, to do the right thing. It was only when you get there and see what the real thing is and the right thing that you do start to think differently.
We were told that Korea was where the communists were coming in, and that the communists were coming through China, and that the Chinese communists were perhaps the worst communists that you could find, and they were termed as the Yellow Peril. And it was in the days of the Menzies era, and it was very much like the McCarthyism, and I think McCarthyism was in train then in America, and so that we were sort of being given lessons of this, and yet we were told that in the Australian Army we weren't to in any way be involved in politics or in religion. But this was a confounding issue because it involved politics, and we were actually being browbeaten that what we were doing was in the long run protecting Australia, because once the Chinese had got through Korea they were coming straight down in the same way as we saw that Japan had done. That then sort of instilled in us a sense of responsibility as a 17-year-old that we were going up there to really cut loose on these dreadful people that were going to come down, and they would take over your mother, your brother and sisters down here in Australia. And the picture that we were confronted with consistently then was that.
It's quite clear now from the releases of documents from the former Soviet archives and from the Chinese archives that Kim Il-sung, the North Korean leader, had kept Stalin fully briefed on what he intended, and that Stalin had given his blessing to the forced incorporation of the de facto southern state under communist rule from the north.
So it's an area, really, that despite the risks, it has to be tested.
Oh yes, I think these sorts of issues were very much in people's minds, but also it's quite clear that Truman and others, in the senior figures in his administration, had the image of Munich in front of them, and the notion that if you didn't stand up to overt aggression when and where it occurred, that you would ultimately be forced to fight later on perhaps more disadvantageous terms. Now, the analogy with Munich was not perhaps the best one, but it was certainly the one that was in their minds. And again, this then feeds back into the business of support for and faith in the United Nations. It was the failure to support the League of Nations with force to stop the dictators in Central Europe and Abyssinia and elsewhere in the second half of the 1930s that many people believed had led to the Second World War. They were not about to repeat that, particularly not in an environment which now had the additional risks of atomic weaponry.
Monday, June the 26th, 1950. The United Nations Security Council today resolved that the attack by North Korean forces constituted a breach of peace. The Council called for an immediate cessation of hostilities and the withdrawal of North Korean forces to the 38th parallel.
The North Koreans begin a multiple-pronged offensive across the 38th parallel and catch the lightly equipped South Korean forces and hammer them pretty hard. And not really surprisingly, given that the South Koreans do not have tanks, they don't have heavy weaponry, they don't have heavy artillery, and they're facing a foe which has been equipped and trained along Soviet lines with all of those things, the South Koreans give way fairly quickly. And the North Koreans bludgeon them essentially down the peninsula. The Americans become, as I've suggested, immediately concerned about this. Initially, they commit air support to try and stem the flow. This is not sufficient. And so Truman's forced to move ground troops from Japan, where they've been on occupation duties since 1945, into South Korea to attempt to bolster the failing forces of the southern state.
Thursday, June the 29th, 1950. The Australian government has placed Her Majesty's Australian ships Shoalhaven and Bataan at the disposal of the United Nations Security Council in support of the Republic of Korea.
I think we realised the very moment we heard that it was breaking up, because we were in the destroyer Bataan. I was the second in command, and we were just leaving Hong Kong that day on our way up to Japan, and it immediately became obvious to us that we would be the first one mixed up in the Korean War. The Americans started off, of course, saying, leave it all to us, we'll just do it with a few bombs dropped, we don't need the Army or the Navy, the Air Force will do it. And within a few days it was obvious they weren't stopping the North Koreans.
They are under strength formations, they are under-equipped, they are under-trained, and initially they don't do terribly well. They too are pushed back. So that within a matter of a very short time, you find that the Americans and the South Koreans are holding a perimeter along the Naktong River outside the southern port city of Pusan. And there's real fear that these forces are going to be swept into the sea by the North Koreans, which is exactly what the North Koreans intend.
The North Koreans attack the South, and of course the Americans were there, and the United Nations had to do something. They sent us over and said that we would join the 27th Brigade, which is two British battalions, the Argylls and Southern Highlanders and the Middlesex, and we were sort of to stem the tide and save South Korea and move the North Koreans out of South.
The great preponderance of the fighting and the dying is borne by the Americans and the South Koreans right through the war. The involvement of the UN contingents was extremely important diplomatically for the United States. It provided a real underpinning of UN presence in the UN command. But it was also, at times, and particularly early in the war, important on the ground as well. The Australian contribution initially on the ground was a battalion, 3RAR, which had been on occupation duties in Japan for some time.
In actual fact, went from Japan. I was there as a guard commander at the Ebisu camp, and we were taken over basically as the Emperor's Guard, as they call it. We interchanged with the Americans on the guard routine, and we were stationed at Ebisu in Tokyo, and then we went across from there to Pusan, and it was on the ferry going across to Pusan. It was like a mill water. It was very calm, and by the time we got into Pusan, it was indeed the land of the morning calm. That's what Korea was called, and it certainly was.
Pusan, which was the main port at that time, was crowded out with refugees from the war, several million of them, and they were living in a shanty town under appalling circumstances, and you could smell it really before you saw the city of Pusan. And the civilian administration had broken down. In fact, that was the first time that I had ever seen starvation. There was a crowd of refugees crowded around the perimeter of our transit camp, when we were having breakfast. I leant through the wire and knocked the scraps of my breakfast into a bowl that was held out, and they were fighting over it. It was the first time I had seen starvation, but it didn't really register on me at that time. There was something like 7 million people out of a population of 20 million were rendered homeless, and the administration could only house so many in emergency camps. And so the rest sort of went as far as they could to Pusan, which was right on the toe of the peninsula, and there they just existed in shanties. A lot of their housing was cardboard boxes opened up and that. They were crowded right on virtually onto the edge of the rail tracks space. They were shoehorned in there by the million. And, of course, you can imagine the sanitary conditions and the starvation and the misery that went on in there.
We then boarded the train, and the train took us up to Yuejongbu. And whilst we were going in the train, of course, we went in the dead of night, and we arrived in the morning to Yuejongbu. And this is where I had my first shock reaction. I'd been through and done the climatisation and done the Kanungra jungle thing, and also up at Japan we'd done the field training with live ammunition and everything, but that is nothing. I mean, the sound of war is nothing. It's a matter of the sound of humanity that's involved in war that's probably more deadly than any bullet, and it's more discerning than any shell blast that you could ever recollect. I was actually probing a anti-personnel mine, and that exploded, and I, of course, get a pension for that now, but that was nothing to what I believe were the cries of women and children. There was in the vicinity of some 5,000 children that were displaced, and it was the Australian Army, that's the Salvation Army, that was actually catering for them and looking after them.
A sight that impressed on me most vividly was a number of refugees in a line getting some form of emergency rations being doled out by the civil administration, I presume, and keeping order in the line were the Republic of Korea soldiers, green uniform blokes, and they belted those people into submission and kept them in the line with rifle butts. That was the extent of the hunger of those people. And I did get close enough to have a look at what they were getting, and which was seemed to be a ration of rice and oatmeal and that, and they were getting a small quantity of potatoes. And believe you me, back on the farm, we wouldn't have given those potatoes to the pigs. They were such poor quality. And yet they were so desperate for them.
You then, in sympathy to them, hand out what we had were ration packs, and we, as Aussies, are prone to do, and I suppose most soldiers perhaps, because they're thinking of home, handed out all that we could. We gave everything that we had. We were told not to, and that was, we went against that because we were young and we had feelings. But we wish we'd have listened to what we were told, because when we started to hand it out, that is when the mayhem came in. We saw children actually with machetes cutting off other children's arms in order to get at black market stuff. Soap was the prize special there, cigarettes, the sea rations, the tins and things like that. That was my first contact with war.
Korea was very old-fashioned, very dirty, and had been run down because the Japanese took everything that was there out of the country, and the people were very poor. Really, the country was nothing, just grew rice, and up north was mainly the minerals, but very, very poor and useless.
Reg Bandy, Ken Colbung and other servicemen who came to Korea. Australian troops had been battle-trained at home and later in Japan, but nothing had prepared them for the Korean climate and the Korean landscape.
Well, the Korean terrain on the east side of it was flat, undulating small hills. In the central sector were very, very steep hills and steep gullies, and very little vegetation on any of the hills at all. The hills were bare, or the mountains were bare, and they were rock, big rock outcrops. And they were like a house. You'd have to go up the ridge cap. You couldn't really go up the side because they were too steep.
The mountains there were so steep and so inhospitable that even the snow couldn't stay on the top. I used to fly over that country, and I was always impressed by the fact that the snow line didn't start until it got below the peaks because it was just too steep for it to stick. So all these mountain ranges had these black peaks running along, and they seemed to run north and south too, which channeled one of the coldest winds you've ever heard about. And it used to come zipping down through Manchuria, right down the peninsula. And if you understand that the 38th parallel north is where the peace line is at the moment, and the 38th parallel south is where Brighton is in Melbourne. And it's a beautiful climate here. It's the same distance from the equator, but it's the chill factor and the height that makes the difference. Australians were not used to that, I can tell you.
And the clothing they were issued with?
Well, we... Australian forces actually went into Korea in their winter clothing, and it was totally inadequate. Now, if it hadn't been for the United States equipping them with warmer clothing, there would have been a lot more problems. As it is, Australians suffered a lot from frostbite. Our equipment just wasn't good enough.
Even the Canadians used to complain about the cold.
Whilst you talk to any Korean veteran, and he'll mention the cold of winter, but most of them seem to forget about the furnace hot summer and the torrential monsoonal rain that we used to get. And you'd be wet through for a week on end, and by the time the monsoon cleared, all your trenches would have collapsed, the hutches would have collapsed, and you started the backbreaking work of rebuilding them again. But the cold is a killer. Rain and heat are not.
We were sitting down the other day, a few of us from all three services, talking about this, and we all said that the thing that surprised us most and really shocked us most was the climate, because we'd gone there in tropical summer weather, lovely weather, and we started the war in that, and we, being an Australian ship, were designed for hot weather service, really. Then as we got back there, winter was setting in, and winter was setting in far more than any of us had ever really met before. I'd been in northern Atlantic waters, I'd been in Scottish waters in midwinter during the previous war, and knew cold pretty well. But for the first time, for instance, we found ourselves pushing through floe ice in salt water. I mean, unless you're in the Antarctic, you don't find ice floating on salt water because it's something you find up the rivers. But off Chinampo, we were pushing through floe ice. The whole of the upper deck of the ships was covered in ice. The guardrails sort of dripping with solid ice, the guns covered in ice. In fact, when we were up off Chinampo, we had a rather quiet time. Nerves were getting a bit jangled. We were sitting, waiting. We could hear the Chinese coming. It was a lovely, still, clear day. And the captain realised the troops were getting a little edgy. And he said, number one, that being me, he said, number one, paint ship. I said, sir. He said, get up some paint pots and give it to the gun screws and get them to paint the upper works and the guns. I said, are you sure, sir? We're at action. So do it, he said. It'll give them something to do. So we got all the paint pots up and we gave the gun screws their paint pots and they painted the gun turrets and the superstructure round about. And that was fine. We put the paint pots away and we then went into action and fired lots of shots. About 3 days later, all the paint fell off because it had been painted over a thin layer of dry ice. And 3 days later, when it warmed up a little, the ice melted and all the paint fell off.
On Life and Times on ABC Radio National Summer Season, you're listening to part one of Korea, the Forgotten War, which was produced by Bill Bunbury in 1998 for Hindsight. Bill.
The Navy, the RAAF and the 3rd Royal Australian Regiment were part of a United Nations force commanded by Commander of US Forces in the Far East, General Douglas MacArthur.
And he comes up with the idea of, drawing upon his Second World War experience in island hopping campaigns, of outflanking the North Koreans by a very bold amphibious assault to go in at Incheon, the port city outside Seoul. At the same time as that's to be carried out, there's to be a simultaneous breakout from the forces on the Naktong perimeter, which have been gradually reinforced. The North Koreans by that stage, of course, are at the end of a long and attenuated line of supply. They're being hit hard from the air on a regular basis. They've pretty much run out of steam offensively. And when they're hit in two directions like this, they begin to crumble and then they, in their turn, break.
After the Marines landed and cut off at Incheon and got in, took Seoul, that cut all the supply off for the North Koreans. And then the main battle, all the other divisions started from the south in Pusan and pushed up and just ran over them. We just didn't want to take prisoners because they were a nuisance.
Then there begins this long chase up the peninsula as the North Koreans withdraw across the 38th parallel. There's debate then about, do the UN forces stop, having restored the status quo? This is where one of the contentious and interesting parts of the war comes about for a brief period. MacArthur, of course, is saying, let's go get them. And we get the emergence, and it only lasts about 6 or 7 weeks, of what's called rollback. It's no longer containment, it's rollback. Let's roll back a communist gain and unite the Korean Peninsula under a southern government. And of course, the southern government's strongly in favour of that. Now, as soon as you begin to get movement north, the Chinese become understandably very nervous and issue a number of clear warnings that if UN forces approach too close to the Yalu, the Chinese will consider this a provocative act and will have to intervene.
The forces massed up north of the Yalu. There were Air Force sections up there, and they were just flying down, making their runs, doing their damage, and flying back again as soon as they crossed that silver stream of river. Safe as a bank. Nobody was permitted to... I think that they were permitted 2 minutes over the border. That's all. They were very, very frightened about the communist state in those years. Well, of course, the red under the bed was the old saying, wasn't it? They never had all the information about Russia, because if China came into it, would Russia back the Chinese up with gear? And that was something that they didn't want happen. So they just simply drew the line and said, right, don't cross over the Yalu River. And it was a bit like schoolboy antagonism, you know, where you stand up on the inside of the school fence and you yell out to... So it was a state thing. The state school kids would stand up on the inside and the Catholic school kids would come on the other side and say, you know, and you'd tease them and then you'd run like blazes back to the sanctity of your school. And it was the same thing.
We still don't know as much as we'd like to about the process of decision-making that went on in the Chinese high command at this time. There is some suggestion that Mao had already formulated ideas about needing to meet the Americans, and MacArthur's actions then gave him the perfect basis for doing so. In any case, the warnings are ignored. MacArthur says contemptuously that, you know, if the Chinese come in, they'll be dealt with in the usual manner. The Chinese infiltrate forces across the Yalu, which UN Allied intelligence almost completely miss. And in October, November, you get the first contacts between Chinese forces and UN forces, which comes as quite a shock. The Chinese come in great strength. The winter is coming. Disaster ensues, and the UN forces are pushed back over the next couple of months, well below the 38th parallel.
About 120,000 came over this bridge in one night and they rolled up 22,000 Americans in no time.
We didn't know just how big the Chinese army was, and it really was tremendous, and well trained. These blokes really were good soldiers. They could travel far and fast. They travelled mostly of a night and they were self-sufficient. They could feed themselves. They would have a sack of rice around their neck. They had
good weapons, superior weapons too. We were still using 1914 weapons, Boer War weapons sometimes, whereas these people had very good weapons indeed.
We referred to the enemy as Charlie, and our enemy was the North Korean Liberation Army and the Chinese People's Volunteers, although we question whether they were volunteers.
Well, originally I went across there totally brainwashed and looked down on them, but it didn't take me long to realise that they were in no position to look down on them because they were good fighters. The Chinese were fairly honourable enemies, and they were much the same as us. With the 2 years that I was there, I only knew of a couple of incidents whereby you could say an atrocity was committed, whereby they machine-gunned a couple of our wounded. If there was a clash in a valley or something along those lines, basically they would leave our wounded and let our stretcher parties come and get them, and vice versa. So really we were fairly evenly matched in honour in that respect. There was a particularly big clash in the Samashon Valley, and the casualties were very heavy, and both sides had withdrawn. And in the morning, first thing in the morning, the Chinese came up on their propaganda loudspeaker and offered to allow our stretcher parties out to pick up the wounded, unarmed stretcher parties. And when we'd finished, they'd do likewise. So our people went out and gathered up our wounded and tended to some of the Chinese while they were there. And then when we'd finished, they came out unarmed with white flags and proceeded to collect their wounded. And the unfortunate aftermath to this story was an unnamed foreign unit nearby waited until the Chinese were sitting ducks and then tore into them with their machine guns and what have you, and inflicted a lot of casualties on the Chinese, and they didn't forgive us for that for a long time.
Corporal led a platoon commander, Ron Cashman. And at the strategic level, the direction of the war was about to change.
Wednesday, April the 11th, 1951. President Truman today relieved General MacArthur of all of his Far Eastern commands.
MacArthur, of course, is famous for having stated that there is no substitute for victory, and he was certainly advocating from early on all sorts of war-widening measures. He wanted to take the war into China. He presented a great many policy difficulties for the Truman administration, which is why, ultimately, Truman sacked him.
We were quite sure that our leader, MacArthur, would lead us into a full war against China, and I think we rather felt perhaps we ought to get it over with. I'm sure that MacArthur, being the warlike fellow he was, wanted us to go over the border and take on China, which would have been perhaps a rather frightening thing, and that's why he was sacked.
The problem with MacArthur, and one needs to be fair to him here, is that the administration had been happy enough for him to adopt a role well outside a narrowly military one for some years in Japan. I mean, he was the supreme authority within occupied Japan, and he functioned in ways that went well beyond that of a, quote, simple soldier. But he'd been like this, remember, during the Second World War. He was very adept in the Southwest Pacific in using the Australian Prime Minister as another means of applying pressure on President Roosevelt and the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington to get him the resources he argued he needed in order to continue prosecuting the war. This was nothing new. What made it more difficult? The overarching presence of atomic weapons. A maverick commander now has the potential to plunge the world into the Third World War.
I think MacArthur really knew that he couldn't use an atomic bomb. The profile of the country, the geographics of it, there was nothing left to bomb other than an army. Well, where was the army? You can't say, well, here they are on X marks the spot. So he would have had to have bombed outside of Korea, their airports and their naval ports. That was an overkill to use an atomic bomb on those. But he wanted the Chinese to know that he had it. So he let them believe that if he had his way, that's what he would use. And being a soldier, he'd use anything at his command.
General MacArthur was replaced by General Matthew Ridgway. One of his first tasks was to bolster morale, badly shaken amongst his own troops by the Chinese advances in early 1951.
Well, I guess it's always difficult to make a lot out of a withdrawal and a defeat. I mean, you know, defeats are gloomy business. And the withdrawals and the panic which gripped some parts of the US Army in that winter retreat was pretty unedifying. And if you read the reports of the brigade commanders, particularly the commander of the 27th Brigade, Brigadier Basil Code, he's absolutely scathing about the performance of many of the American troops and of many of their senior officers as well, and not without cause. He tells a number of stories, one in particular that I recall. He's called in one day by an American commander, senior general, who says, you know, we're terribly pleased to see you Brits and Australians here holding the line of our retreat. And Code makes the observation to him fairly bluntly that he might be pleased, but that he and his men are getting a little tired of holding these sorts of positions. It was not a terribly inspiring period, but the troops involved, the Brits, the Australians, the New Zealand gunners, the Canadians when they come in early in 51, perform at a very high level indeed. And when Matthew Ridgway takes over command of the 8th Army, which he does after Walton Walker is killed in a vehicle accident in December 1950, he goes around his army, which is clearly demoralised and battered, and he makes the observation a number of times in his correspondence that the one inspiring thing he finds is the willingness of the Commonwealth troops not to throw in the towel and actually to go and come to grips with the Chinese. And he holds that fighting spirit up very positively to his American soldiers as he tries to rebuild his forces.
During this phase, when it's realised that this war could go on forever, what attempts are made to resolve it?
Well, initially not much. Whilst it appears, of course, that the UNC is winning the war as they're pushing the North Koreans back, that doesn't leave much room for negotiation. It's really only by mid-1951 when the Chinese, after the fifth phase offensive, are basically exhausted. They've given it the best shot they can, and they have been unable to push the UNC into the sea, push them out of the country. And at the same time, roughly, the calculations are being made on the UN side. Remember, this is now after MacArthur has been removed. Ridgway, a much more realistic man and much more finely politically attuned soldier, is now commanding the United Nations Command. And he and his senior planners decide that the effort that will be needed to push the Chinese and the North Koreans out of the theatre is greater than is worth paying. The blood bill will be too high. It's really only when you get that stalemate, when both sides sit back reasonably exhausted and do their calculations and reason that neither side is going to be able or willing to pay the price of bringing the conflict to a dramatic, traditional, victorious conclusion, that you then get the beginnings of what becomes the drawn-out truce talk process at Panmunjom.
Sunday, July the 8th, 1951. Allied and Communist representatives agreed at Kaesong today to start full-scale negotiations there on Tuesday for a ceasefire in Korea. Official circles in Washington believe that even if the ceasefire talks are successful, the fighting in Korea will continue for several weeks.
In fact, the peace talks were to drag on for another 2 years. But the nature of the struggle had changed. The armies were no longer chasing each other up and down the peninsula. They now dug in and faced each other for the rest of the war.
Monday, July the 21st, 1952. The Korean War might well be the 1914-18 war over again, Lieutenant Colonel F.G. Hassett said last night. He said, the soldier in Korea, like the soldier of the First World War, lives underground in a hole. The earth is red and soft, and now in the rainy season becomes sticky mud.
We lived in what was known as Huchis. I believe the name is derived from Uchi, meaning Japanese for house. We picked up a lot of Japanese words which sort of came into our language, and the Huchi was a pit dug into the ground and sandbagged. It could be completely underground or partially underground, and on average I'd say that'd be about the size of a bathroom, and they were always overcrowded and always uncomfortable. And the worst feature was that we roofed them with logs and the rats infested them. And you'd have rats scratching and squealing in the log roof, and those rats were disease carriers. But I can't remember any hemorrhagic fever which was attributed to lice from rats. But we were sprayed with chemical, you know, DDT, which on reflection was probably more dangerous than the rats, but we weren't to know that at the time.
You just loosen your belt and squirt down a bit of DDT and down your neck, and you used to rub it into the seams of your clothing because that's where the lice would congregate, and then you'd put your shirt back on. Nobody knew in those days just how disastrous DDT was. And Dieldrin? they won't allow Dieldrin to be used anymore, but it was quite common. I never got lousy at any time, so apparently the blokes that I used to camp with were pretty clean. But the rats and the mice were bad, and they used to, and the lice would cause hemorrhagic fever, which is something that was quite unique to this place. I believe that when it first happened, the poor blokes would be bleeding from and vomiting from almost any orifice, including the eyes and the ears, and pretty dicey. It not only killed them, but left them with lifelong problems after that too. Some of them were sent back to Australia to recover, if they were lucky. The others are still buried up there.
Early in 52, the UN decided that petrol would be available for heating and cooking purposes. That was very good for ones at General Headquarters and senior officers, because there were a few space heaters issued on a seniority rank, but the rest of us, well, we had supplies of petrol, but we had to figure out a way to make heaters. So it was some weird and wonderful ones made from whatever you could scrounge, varying from cut-off cans with earth in them and just petrol poured into it and set alight, to others that were made out of shell cases and shell containers for flues with carburetors, which were knocked off of any disabled vehicle you could get hold of.
During the winter of 52-53, there were a colossal number of burns, some very serious, some fatal. And this happened because the petrol stoves that the boys manufactured would occasionally blow up. I remember being in a field ambulance, the British field ambulance, in the guest tent, just a tiny little tent, with a petrol feed dripping onto sand, and that terrified me, but you had to have it on, otherwise you froze.
I mean, the first patient, the day I went on duty for the first time in Cure, my first patient as such was a British soldier who had been very badly burned, and he was nursed, completely uncovered, and we had a special bath for this man, and twice a day he was bathed, immersed completely into this. And this was dreadful. It was terrible for him. He had morphine beforehand, mm-hmm. and even the giving of morphine to find a place that wasn't burned for the morphine injection was really harrowing. However, that man survived, and we were We were all thrilled to bits when he was well enough to be evacuated back to the UK. But we had a special burns ward, didn't we, where they were all burns. And somebody spoke about you knew which way you were going by the smells.
We had burns come in, some shocking burns. That was always very sad to see. I think a combat injury is bad enough, but a burn like that, I think it can have a big psychological effect too on how you're going to look afterwards.
There were very few who were resentful of being hurt. I mean, the only one I can remember in my first impression was an Australian who had been blinded. And yes, he was quite justifiably resentful and hated everybody and everything. But all the others, however badly wounded or hurt,
yes,
were, as you say, very optimistic.
Nurse Peggy Webster and her husband, Dr. Charles Webster, whom she met while serving in Korea. And the war was now proving costly in many other ways.
The amount of petrol used was horrific because all vehicles, including tanks, had to have the engines running 20 minutes out of every hour, 24 hours a day, otherwise they'd freeze up and crack the blocks. I did hear at the time that in February, 3 Battalion used something like between 70 and 80,000 gallons of petrol. And that was static. That was mainly just, you know, keeping people warm and stopping the engine from freezing.
Well, I never knew it at the time because I took it for granted. That was the only way you kept warm or that was the only way you cooked your food or whatever. But in retrospect, the fuel that was used for these little hoochie fires were whatever you could scrounge, petrol, dieseline, kero, metho, whatever. And as you know, some of those diesel fumes are very bad for you. And I believe now, in later life, in the number of Korean veterans that I know who have terrible diseases and skin problems, have been exposed to various chemicals that were in there, and they have not been recognised as being caused by war service.
Murray Inwood and the long-term effects of war. And that's one of the issues we take up next week. Today you also heard from Des Guilfoyle, John Lewis, Shirley Bennetts, Ken Colbung, Betty Hunt-Smith, Doug Whitehurst, Reg Bandy, Commodore Dacre Smythe, Peggy and Charles Webster, Ron Cashman and Geoffrey Gray. Studio production for Hindsight Today, Ron Sims. I'm Bill Bunbury and I'll be back next week at the same time with Korea, the Forgotten War, Part 2.
On ABC Radio National, you've been listening to Part 1 of Korea, The Forgotten War, which was produced by Bill Bunbury in 1998 for Hindsight. And don't forget, if you'd like to hear this program again, you can by going to our website, abc.net.au/rn/Life and Times. Until next week, bye for now.